It's an interesting place in the Bible that we go to today, but much like a therapy session, I need for you all to buy in. So I want you to say something out loud with me that you may not feel at this point, but by the time you hear the message, I think you'll be in agreement with me. So I want you to admit this. I hate to admit it, but I've lost my confidence. Say that with me. I hate to admit it, but I've lost my confidence. And that takes us to the book of Philippians in the third chapter, and we'll start with the first four verses. And again, kind of a strange passage of Scripture, but it'll get us to where we need to be. Further, my brothers and sisters, rejoice in the Lord. It's no trouble for me to write the same thing to you again, and it is a safeguard for you. Watch out for those dogs, those evildoers, those mutilators of the flesh, for it is we who are the circumcision, we who serve God by His Spirit, who boast in Christ Jesus, and who put no confidence in the flesh. Though I myself have reasons for such confidence, if someone else thinks they have reasons to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. At the Bible seminary, I had an Old Testament professor, and I was supposed to preach on this passage in 1 Samuel, and it had all these big names of people and places that a hick boy from Vivian, Indiana couldn't pronounce, and I told him, I want to do this right. You're going to have to help me pronounce some of these names so I can practice. And he said to me, my college professor said this, it's not important that you say them right as long as you say them with confidence. That's what he told me. My Old Testament professor. Nobody will know the difference if you're just confident. Well, he didn't know it, but that's how all my relatives in Kentucky are. They use words differently than you and I use. I mean, I'm from the South, you know, southern Indiana. And my family is from further south than that, but they use words differently, and they're confident. For instance, mayonnaise, they would say, mayonnaise a lot of people here today. Or aorta. Aorta cut the grass down by the ball field. Or initiate. My wife ate two hamburgers, initiate a bag of chips. Or which you did you? Hey, you didn't bring your truck, which you did you? See, as long as you say it with confidence, I figure you're related to me if. You're related to me if you ever used a weed eater as a trolling motor. You're related to me if you ever decorated a cake with a caulking gun. You're related to me if you tried to roast a hot dog using a bug zapper. Anybody? I'm the only one. Seriously? You're related to me if you want to clean out your ears but you can't find your truck key. And you're related to me if you take the red ribbon from around the bologna and floss your teeth with it. One of our family reunions, my cousin was eating a piece of pie. Aunt Gracie walked up to him and said, how do you like my pie? And he said, honestly, Gracie, this is the best pie I ever ate. And she said, how about my crust? And he said, truthfully, I'm afraid to cut into the crust. It's so beautiful. I don't want to mess it up. It's the most beautiful crust I have ever seen in my life and so pretty around the edge. How did you do that? She said, well, it's a secret. He said, well, I won't tell anybody. She said, okay, I'll tell you how I do that. She said, I get all the ingredients mixed up in a bowl, and then I put the dough in the pan, and then I take out my teeth and go around the edge. That's why we eat a lot of cake at our family reunion. So say what you want. We are a confident bunch. But I can tell you what's happening in our culture today in one sentence. In our culture, we have confidence without competence. And that's dangerous. It's one thing to be confident when you're right. But to be confident, so confident when you're wrong, is leading us down some dangerous roads. We're approaching it like they were approaching it in Philippians 3, where Paul says you need to watch out for the dogs. So you read that and you're probably asking, well, who are the dogs and who let them out? Well, he's not talking about the drug dealers or the liberals of his day. He's talking about the religious people who are trying to get the newly converted Gentiles who weren't Jewish to be circumcised with no anesthesia, mind you, because that was an outward sign of the covenant they had between the Jewish nation and God. But Jesus came along and he changed all that. And Paul knows it's not what you can show on the outside that proves you really belong to him. It's what's going on with your heart and what's going on the inside. And it's a perversion of the gospel to think that there are things that we can do outwardly that will put us in good standing with God when we haven't been willing to let him do anything with us inwardly. Now, I don't know about you, how differently you feel after you've been through the battles life brings your way. I mean, I was confident when I was younger. I gave my life to the Lord when I was 11. Anybody 11 or under or young when you gave your life to the Lord? Many of us. I was pretty confident that I could live for Jesus. I really was. And then I found out how difficult temptation is and how difficult peer pressure can be. When I first got married, I was confident that just like with my parents and their parents, my marriage would last the rest of my life. And then my confidence was shaken. When I had children, I was pretty confident that none of my kids would ever be held in the grip of addiction. And then my confidence was shaken. When I started in ministry, I was confident that I could handle any situation that life threw my church. And then I was asked after 3 weeks there to do the funeral of a 3-year-old boy who had been tragically backed over by his dad. Here's what I've come to realize. It was easy to be confident when I never lived through a crisis. Easy to preach faith and perseverance when you haven't watched your grandpa struggle with Alzheimer's. Easy to preach faith and perseverance when you haven't watched your uncle crushed by ALS. Or you haven't watched your best friend die with cancer in front of you. Easy when there's no crisis to be confident. Paul is talking about people who have lost their confidence in the gospel and are putting their confidence in their own performance. And I don't know which is worse, being underconfident or being overconfident, because the lawyer in me could make the case for both. Underconfident shows you lack faith and trust in God. Overconfidence leads to pride and arrogance. So I'm trying to find a balance. I want to be a confident Christian. And I want to raise confident kids. And there's a fine line between too much and too little. I remember when Jared was starting into basketball and golf, I wanted him to be confident in his ability, but I didn't want him to be cocky. Again, it's a fine line. And I would talk about him from the pulpit, and I had a man in my church who did not like me talking about my kids in the pulpit. Didn't like it one bit. Called me out on it, because I, like I do here. I mean, I don't know how else to preach except to use life lessons, but he called me out on it, said he didn't like it, didn't want to hear about my kids anymore. Here's what he said. Stop talking about your kids so much in your sermons. We don't come to hear about your kids. We come to hear the Word of God. Well, I had another solution that didn't include me not talking about my family. How about you find a preacher who never talks about his family, and then we can both be happy. Of course, I said it in the love of Jesus. We obviously didn't share the same interest. I'm interested in my family, and he was not. I boarded a plane to Chicago once from Cincinnati. It's only like a 2-hour flight. And I sat next to this elderly lady who looked just like Ann Smith. Matter of fact, when I met Ann Smith and I came here, I wondered if she was the lady from the plane. That's how much they look alike. And this lady started talking. And I'm a talker, but she would not give me an opening. So she talked about her kids, her grandkids, from Cincinnati to Chicago, about 2 hours, the whole time. And finally, the little ding went off, and they announced that we're about to land in Chicago. And it was like the ding was her alarm clock. And she said, "Oh, my, I realize I have talked the whole time." And I'm thinking, "Yeah, you have." And she said, "So, Mark, I'm sorry I've talked to you for 2 hours about my kids. It's your turn." And then she said, "So what do you think about my kids?" So it wasn't really my turn. I've watched my kids like you on football fields and sweaty gyms. get involved in different things. They had some ability, but not always the confidence that I thought they needed to succeed. And in some ways, I tried to force it. I tried to force it with Jayla. Her first year of organized basketball, they started pretty young, but they bought these new uniforms that were pretty cool. And her coach has them huddled up. And instead of listening to her coach in the huddle, my girl's trying to get my attention in the stands. Dad! So I'm kind of pumped about that. Because maybe she's wanting to talk to me about a three-man weave or a zone defense or a 1-3-1 or something. And she thinks her dad knows more than the coach. I like that. So I come down. Well, no, she didn't want to ask me any basketball questions. She had written a cheer for the team. They should have banned cheers for kids that age. I may have given her too much confidence because her cheers were never true. One Saturday, they're getting beat down 48-4. They kept score, 48-4 with a minute left, and my little girl shouts, "My name is Jayla, do you know what I got?" And the team shouts back, "Tell us, Jayla, what do you got?" "I got a team that is hotter than hot." "Look at the scoreboard, girl. You ain't even lukewarm, baby girl." It's not easy to strike a balance. Too much confidence, not enough confidence. So since we can't really do that, it doesn't become a question of how much confidence do you have. It becomes a question of where does your confidence lie. Through, it's a pretty simple formula. To have confidence, you have to have competence. And competence is built through consistency. So the biblical conclusion goes something like this. It's not how much confidence you have. It's where you put it that counts. And Paul, in this passage, tells us where not to put it and where to put it. That's my outline. Tells us not to put it in the flesh. Do not put your confidence in the flesh. The Bible's description of people who put their confidence in the flesh is always a picture of somebody legalistic or negative. And I know why they're always negative. Because they believe that somehow if they're morally good, that earns their spot in heaven. So when they fail, and they will, over and over, it brings them down. Fortunately for me in my life, I learned I was a screw up early on. Pretty good lesson, because I've been a grace clinger from day one, realizing if I put confidence in me in being able to toe this line that God has set, then I'm going to fail every time. And I'm not alone. How many of you at the beginning of the year, "Oh, I'm going to stay on my diet this year. I'm going to start January 1. I'm going to exercise every day. I'm going to pray for 15 minutes every day. I'm going to read the Bible through this year. I'm telling you, that's what I'm going to do. I'm confident I'll get it done." Yeah, well, how's that going? Not so great, huh? Someone told me they quit going to church here because some people from our church let them down. Now, I can't dispute that they were let down. Maybe they were. But it brings up a question. Your relationship with God is so precious. Why would you put your confidence in God in how people treat you? Don't you know people will always let you down? They will. Even with good intentions, they will. They don't have the ability to not let you down. You want to put your confidence in people? In your flesh, in your effort, in your ability to get it right, we can't even control our own thoughts. I mean, I can't be the only one who's focused on something and then a random thought just, boom, shoves its way in my right ear. You have random thoughts, people? Let me see your hands. You know, I mean, you're focused on this and all of a sudden, I want pizza, whatever it might be. I wonder if the Reds are beating the Yankees right now. Stuff like that, just boom. I found a little video of a little girl who was, she loved waffles, and she was told she couldn't have waffles for lunch or dinner. I want you to watch her response. Check this out.
"I just can't stop thinking about waffles."
A Vacaville dad recorded this hilarious video of his daughter after she insisted she wanted waffles for lunch and for a third meal in a row. Mom and dad felt she needed to take a break from the waffles and suggested she eat something else. But there's only one thing on her mind.
"Why can't I just stop dreaming about waffles?"
I don't know.
Yeah. thoughts just come into my head. Like, wow, where did that come from? And I'm reading this passage, and it's all about confidence. And Paul, I don't know if you catch this. You almost have to hear his tone, but I think I can. This is a game of my dad is bigger than your dad. He's like, my circumcision's better than yours. That's basically what he's saying. So you want to put confidence in fleshly things, I'll just tell you. I can top you. Verses 5 and 6. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law, a Pharisee as for zeal, persecuting the church, as for righteousness, based on the law, faultless. That's what he's saying about himself. He's saying you want to be confident. Let me tell you about somebody who can be confident, and that's me. I was circumcised on the eighth day. That's when it's supposed to be. You all are getting it done after the fact. I got it done when it was supposed to be. I was of the people of Israel. Not only that, I was the tribe of Benjamin. That's the tribe that all the kings came from. You want to talk about flesh, you dogs? My flesh is impressive. In his conclusion, so if anyone should have confidence in the flesh, it's me. So let's make sure we got this. He's connected. He's competent. His character, according to the human law, and what you can measure and what you can see and what you can judge, faultless. So he built his confidence to a certain level, and then Paul saw a contrast. And sometimes that's what we need when we get a little too full of ourselves. When we start to trust in the flesh, pride begins to take over. And I'll be honest, I can't tell you who's a godly person anymore. I don't know. I've baptized lots of people. I don't know what was in their heart. I've seen people come to, I don't know. I don't know. Can't see what's going on, really, between them and the Lord. I'm watching one of my favorite preachers years ago on TV in a dorm room in Cincinnati. And my roommate, who's kind of gruff, he's from northern Ohio, had a big beard, and Big Tim, we called him. He's like, that guy's fake. And I think he knew I kind of liked the guy. So look at him strutting around there, and he's cocky. He's arrogant. I bet that suit costs $5,000. And I don't know if he's just poking at me or really thinks this guy's fake. You know, have you met him? Well, no, but he's fake. I can tell. He said, look, you can just tell. Well, no, I can't. Maybe you can, but have you met anybody who has met him? No, but he's fake. So he kind of got my goat a little bit. I knew he wanted to fight. I said, well, who do you model preaching that you and I could look at and say, that's somebody we want to emulate? He said, well, there's this guy in Ohio who basically had the Greek New Testament memorized. He said he's the real deal. He's not flashy, but he knows his Bible, and he is the real deal. A year later, me and Tim had a conversation because the man of God who knew the Bible from Ohio that was the real deal had left his wife for a woman in Russia. He'd been taking frequent mission trips to Russia. Mission trips to Russia. But one mission, he went and never came back. And the man that Tim thought was cocky and arrogant is old but still in ministry today, and so are his kids, and they're bringing hundreds of people to know the Lord. The lesson for me, stop being so quick to categorize people based on what we see with our eyes or where they are in certain behaviors of their life. Judge nothing until the appointed time. You don't even know what battles someone is fighting. You don't know how far they've come. You don't know what it's taken them just to keep running the race. And I'll be completely transparent. I put no confidence in the flesh. None. Some of the people I thought were really in tune with God were faking it. They were. You know how I know? Because when life became difficult, they bailed. And when someone let them down, they bailed. And when the church didn't come through the way they thought a church should, they bailed. And when the preacher took another job or ministry or had to leave in the middle of a scandal, they bailed. Put no confidence in the flesh. Don't trust in people. Trust in God. He will never let you down. So that's where we should put our confidence, according to Paul. Put your confidence in your faith. One of the phrases I grew up with in the church that I attended as a child was this thought that you just have to, You just have to have faith. That's it. We just have to have faith. Whenever a question couldn't be answered that I would ask, that was the answer. And it drove me nuts. Well, how come this? Well, why did God do this? Well, how did it? Well, you just have to have faith, Mark. Little Mark, stop asking your questions. You just have to have faith. That's a terrible answer. Now, I believe in faith. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. I sing, great is thy faithfulness. But I don't like it when someone will respond, don't ask me how it works. Don't bother me with the details. Don't talk to me about scientific fact. Faith, 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 faith. Just have faith, brother. As if faith exists apart from evidence and proof and tangible reasons to believe. Just take it by faith. That's not enough for me. I want to be confident in my faith. I want a faith that's steadfast and sure. I watched this guy the other night. I don't watch him very often. But he said something that made my blood boil. He often does. He said religion at its heart is an attempt to explain things by people who just don't know any better. In other words, he's saying you need faith because you're ignorant and uneducated. And now people are academic and things are based on science, so faith is no longer needed. Now, of course, he's the same guy who said when he died he wanted to go like Frank Sinatra, where they bury me, I want to go with a bottle of Jack Daniels, a pack of cigarettes, and a lighter. There's your last wishes right there. Now, you know me, I'm no man's judge. But if I had to guess where he's going, he'll probably want water instead of Jack Daniels, and he probably has no need for a lighter. You know what I'm saying? I don't get offended very easily, but I take great offense when someone concludes faith is the opposite of proof or truth or science or reality. What we're told over and over is while the educated study rocks, those of us with faith are dumber than a box of rocks. I reject that. All of the anti-God, anti-creation sentiment coming now at the church has rushed in the last two decades at an incredible rate of speed. Me and Jeff and Phil and Randy were talking one day about cars that had those old window wings. Remember the wings? This will show your age. How many of you remember the wings that would flip out? That's right. They were cool, weren't they? Because you'd flip those babies out. Corey, you have no idea what these are, do you? That's right. Still a baby. Flip these wings on the front of the window. You just flip them out. And the air will rush in those wings about 150 to 200 miles an hour. Just whoosh. It was awesome. The downside is whatever was in the air would rush in those wings too. So me and my mom were going to church one Sunday, and everybody else had already gone, and we're bringing the second vehicle. And the biggest bumblebee you ever saw, whoosh, rushed into that window wing on my side. Now, I know I can be prone to exaggeration, but this bumblebee looked like a bird. That's a big bumblebee. And he got lodged in my sweater, right in my belly button. And I'm freaking out. And it stings me, and I'm freaking out, and I'm yelling, and my mom, who is so sensitive, says, "Shut up!" And then she makes two of the most ridiculous statements I've ever heard in all my life. Ridiculous statement number one, if you don't bother the bee won't bother you. What? I'm only 12 years old, and truthfully, I don't know what bothers a bee. Maybe the bee don't want to go to church. And I'm thinking, if you hit that window going 60 miles an hour, you're probably bothered already. So he gets in right there. This is something you probably don't know about your... There was room for that bee to set up shop, if that's what I'm saying. And he got in my innie, and he wouldn't come out. And he stung me. That thing hurt and itched for days, leading my mom to the second ridiculous comment. If you ignore it, it's like it's not even there. Brilliant. Well, I think maybe the church has taken her advice. With all that's being thrown at the church today, all these rock-solid truths that have been set for years being assaulted. And it's almost like our conclusion is, well, if we ignore it, it's like it's not even there. Well, it's there. And we can't ignore it any longer. And I refuse to be put on the defense because I have faith, as if that somehow is not legitimate as science and evidence and proof that people are looking for. Because in my mind, my faith isn't some shot in the dark. It's built on fact. My faith is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I had a biology teacher. I was talking to a young man in first service. He, like me, hated biology. I hated biology. Oh, terrible subject. And my biology teacher looked like Winston Churchill. His name was Denny Markland, and him and my dad were buddies. And I had a paper at home that I had to, it's like a test, and it had questions. And I thought, I was pretty sure he wasn't going to be able to offer me much help, but I thought, let's see what Dad says about this. So I showed Dad my paper from my biology class. He laughs, and he says, well, only God would know the answer to these questions. So that's what I wrote on 5 of the 10. Didn't know what else to do. Only God would know the answer to this question. 5 times out of 10. Mr. Markland gave my paper back with a note in red ink. It said, God gets an A, you get an F. That's what it said. So he taught us this. Start with observations that lead to a hypothesis. Your hypothesis leads to a theory. Your theory can be empirically verified. And that formula is presented as if it contradicts the truth of the Bible, when in reality, it actually fits the Bible. I'll give you a few examples after I read Psalm 19, 1 and 2. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal what? Knowledge. So how about this? Just a few examples. Number one, early sources declared the earth was held by Atlas or set on the back of an elephant or a giant turtle. But Job 26, 7 has always said he suspends the earth over nothing. Not until the 1800s was it discovered that all visible matter consists of invisible elements. But Hebrews 11, 3 has always said, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. How about this? Shipbuilders today have standard dimensions for a stable water vessel. The ideal dimension for stability is a length 6 times that of the width. Genesis 6, 15. The ark, the first boat to be constructed, is to be 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide. The length is 6 times that of the width. Number four, for centuries, people naively washed in standing water. Today, we understand the need to wash away germs in fresh water. Leviticus 15, 13 has always said he must wash his clothes and bathe himself with fresh water and he will be clean. Number five, up until a couple hundred years ago, sick people were bled, and many died as a result of taking blood out of them. Today we know that healthy blood is necessary to bring life-giving nutrients to every cell in the body. We don't take blood, we give blood. Leviticus 17, 14 has always said the life of every creature is in its blood. Do you know how many miles we are from the sun? 93 million. 93 million miles, and yet here we are, the perfect distance from that sun, 93 million miles away, to reap all of the benefits from this distance. Where that distance increased half more, do you know what would happen? No vegetation, no animals, no life, because everything here would be froze. Where that distance half what it is, that would mean you and I would be crispy critters before we could say good morning. The moon is 252,000 miles away from us. At its closest point, it's 225,000 miles. Were it to just scoot a little bit closer, giant tides would inundate this earth and there would be no life here. When a meteor hits the earth's atmosphere, it goes from traveling through a vacuum to traveling through air, causing it to heat up and burns itself out. This happens on a regular basis. Were the atmosphere thinner than it is, those meteors would pound planet earth and destroy life as we know it. My faith is built on fact. It's not a leap in the dark. It's based on science and knowledge. There is a known evolutionist, Bertrand Russell. I think we got a picture of him. Looks like a happy camper, doesn't he? Listen to what he wrote. In the visible world, the Milky Way is a tiny fragment, but in this fragment, the solar system is a tiny speck. And within this speck, our planet is a tiny dot. On this tiny dot, and here's where he gets to us, impure clumps of carbon and water crawl about for a few years until they're dissolved again into the elements into which they're compounded. How would you like to have me refer to you that way at your funeral? Doug, I'll just pick you out. Not that you're going anytime soon, brother, all right? But we got Doug's funeral, and I get up here in the pulpit, and I say, oh, bless him, Lord. He was a little lump of carbon crawling around for a while. Now he's gone back to the slime he crawled out of one day. I mean, if he's right and the universe is just a machine, an accidental machine that one day is going to wind down, does it matter how I raise my kids? Does it matter what values I hold? Does it matter if I'm kind or caring? Listen, we have a hunger for food, right? It would be odd if we were created and there were no food. We have a thirst for water. It would be odd if we were created and there were no water. And we have a desire for meaning in our life. And it would be odd if we were created and there was no meaning. Well, there is, and I'm confident of that. Not because of confidence in the flesh, but because of confidence in my faith. Paul finished the passage we started with verse 7. Whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them garbage, that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith. A couple years ago, a little more, on a Monday morning, my daughter, Jerrica, Buzz, called me to tell me that Rob had died. So I threw some clothes in the car and headed down there. And a reality of life kind of slapped me in the face. Not that I didn't know this was true, but it became kind of overwhelming. Everything on the earth that we hope for will eventually disappoint us. Now, I know you probably didn't come here to be depressed, but it's true. Everything on earth that we hope for will eventually disappoint us. So I go to spend time with my daughter. We're dealing with something we've never dealt with before, and my heart's breaking for her. We take a walk, and the house was full of people, so we walked to the park. And she said something to me that not only lifted my spirits, but just kind of made me feel like, golly, I've done something right with this girl. I wrote down what she said. I'll never forget it. She said, Dad, when you've lost something that you were hoping for, all you can do is trust the one you're hoping in. Is that beautiful or what? When you've lost something you're hoping for, all you can do is trust the one you're hoping in. I've seen pictures of Jesus all my life. They all look serious, like he's mad or he's concentrating or he's just unhappy. I think we got pictures, don't we, Jamie? There he is. And he always looks the same, and we don't know what he looked like. But I picture him more like with children. He's smiling and happy. And so when I compared those pictures, a thought hit me. And I'll close with this, since this was a therapy session for me. Taking ourselves too seriously is a sign that we aren't taking Jesus seriously enough. How about that? Right? Taking ourselves too seriously is a sign that we aren't taking Jesus seriously enough. Because the answer for your life and mine, it's not more confidence. It's more Christ. And I'm confident of that. Amen?